Well, from O to sigma. So you can think of O as like the Higgs doublet, if you want. It's a field that's going to get a vacuum expectation value. But here we're focusing not on the Higgs field, which is the excitation that goes up and costs you potential energy. So we fix that at like zero, but we want to take into account the Goldstone bosons, which are like the imaginary part of H plus, which are like H plus and the imaginary part of H zero. And so those are put in sigma. And you find out what directions in field space they correspond to by taking the VeV and transforming it under the parts of the group that are under the group transformations. And the ones that are broken generators will move you in directions of field space that characterize the massless particles. And so we had a matrix there. I think it was L dagger R. And so those are the directions in field space. It's a unitary matrix. And so we just promote that to space-time dependent. That's where the fields live. And that's why we put them in there. Sigma has an expectation value of one. And so I wanted to write it in a way. The Goldstone bosons, the pi, the k, the eta, they're excitations about that. So that's why I wrote it as exponential I m over f. The two is just my convention. And that's also very convenient because then m transforms in a very simple way under the unbroken SU3 vector group. So, yeah, it's not a very, I don't. So it's a little bit subtle, actually. So we should think of O like the big H. The thing that's going to get an expectation value. It's got a lot of fields in it, and it's going to get an expectation value, and then there's going to be excitations of it that correspond to massless degrees of freedom. For H, that we had the Higgs mechanism. They went away. They were gauge artifacts. They went into the W and Z longitudinal polarizations, but here we have none of that part. They just stick as physical particles, the pi, the k, the eta. Well, here they're global transformations. We can't gauge anything away. So here's how I would say the correspondence is. H is like our O. H, and then the imaginary part of H zero and H plus are like the M. So that's how I would, I think that's roughly the correspondence. And the real part, I guess I should put a capital here. I don't remember the notation I used before. But the real part of H0, we set that to zero here. That's the analog in our case. This is, oh, there's a zero and there's an O. Let me call it OJK. These are matrices. Sorry. Why do we set the analog of the Higgs field to zero? Because that's a massive degree of freedom. It takes you up the potential. It's not a massless excitation. And we're trying to just do the physics of the pi, the k, the eta. So let me answer your question now about how to. So let me write a few things on the board, and then I'll elaborate more than I did in my notes on how to identify the fields. So we started off with the Q left. then we introduced sigma, which goes to left, sigma, right dagger, and sigma was exponential 2i m over f. And then I told you how to put the fields in m. I don't remember, so let me write that down. So I haven't told you what F is yet. It's just a constant, and it has dimensions of mass because scalar fields in M have dimensions of mass. And we'll talk a little bit later how you determine it experimentally. So right in, I haven't got to much phenomenology yet. We're really setting up the conceptual points, the theory. Okay, so, and under the unbroken subgroup, so the unbroken SU3 vector subgroup where V equals L equals R, M. I'm missing a column, cool. Thanks. So it's got to be traceless and Hermitian because, oh, yeah. It's going to be rough today. Thank you. Okay, so let's talk about, vector transformations. So let's imagine I made an infinitesimal vector transformation. And I want to make a vector transformation that corresponds to rho, so let's say I made it like this, 1 plus I, a matrix that looked like this. Oh. Let me see how I want to say this. I guess I have to put a 1 here, right, for it to be in the group. Let's say this is my V to start with. I pick a particular transformation near the identity. So this is a traceless Hermitian matrix. It's allowed. And then we ask, what does this do to the quarks? So this takes U, D, S goes to U, D, S plus I, alpha. And what do I get back? So the S goes to the U. So I basically flip at, oh. So the new U is the, so I base, yeah. Sorry. So this is what it does to the quarks. This SU3 vector transformation. And so we can ask, what should it do to, you got a question? I haven't done anything yet. It's okay though.
Is there a 1 in the second row?
I can't hear you.
For the second row and second column, that
is there a 1 here?
Would it be traceless?
No, this is the identity here. It's mostly 1, 1, 1. Yeah. This is an infinitesimal SU3 vector transformation. Probably we can do it for finite ones. But since I haven't prepared anything, I'll make it as trivial as I can, or simple as I can. Okay? So what should this do? Let's say I have a field that's pi plus. So a pi plus is a u bar, is a ud bar. It's just as far as the flavor content's concerned. And so under this transformation, a pi plus should go to pi plus I alpha. And basically I've I alpha the thing that k naught bar. Because a k naught bar is equal to s d bar. And so then what I would do is I would take, so I could take this matrix M and I could just truncate it to the field k naught bar and the pi plus, transform it, and see if it did that. And if it does that, then I put them in the right places in the matrix. And similarly, you could do other transformations to check they're all in the right place. Is that clear for everybody? So, of course, people figured this out in the 1960s when Gell-Mann proposed SU3 symmetry, but for us, this is how we would do it. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, so if the pi plus has just u and d bar, we've seen how a vector with u, d, and s transforms, then how exactly do we put this together?
How exactly do we put, which thing is confusing you here?
So pi plus just has two
components,
that's a u and d bar.
No, it's a single object, but it's the pro. It's, so as a state, you could think of it as the state. Like if you say a hydrogen atom is made up of an electron and a proton, the state vector is a product of the state in the two particle space. You write it as a product of the electron and the proton.
It's just the pi plus. In the context of the pi plus, we're concerned with UD bus. And previously we saw how UDS transforms. I'm just not sure how to put together the UDS with the UD bus.
Well, so I would transform this, and the U would go to U plus I alpha S, and the D would stay the same, because it doesn't change there, and so I would get U d bar plus I alpha s d bar, just ordinary quantum mechanics, and this is the k naught bar. It's actually pretty important, this part, because if you don't really know this part, you don't understand what's going on. So I'm happy to take more questions till people feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm. So you can deduce the transformation of d bar by p.
Well, you could then do other particular transformations to fill out the rest of the matrix. You know, the SU3 has got 8 generators, and you could do it either all at once with infinitesimal ones, or you can just do them one at a time to figure out where the particles go. I've never actually gone through the whole exercise, because, you know, I just copied the formula from the old papers, but I did check a few of the elements when I get confused. Okay, should we keep it going?
Can I just clarify? So that's one of the generators you chose.
Yeah.
So there are 8 others that you can.
Yeah, but you know, I'd have to do more things to figure out where everything is in the matrix. I just wanted to do a little example. Okay, so we were in the business of constructing the Lagrangian last time. This is basically we've done sort of 70% of the physics that goes into this, to be honest with you. But there's more to come. Okay, so we're in the business of constructing the Lagrangian, and of course there's an infinite number of possibilities, but we wanted some organizing principle, And since we're working at low momentum, we decided the organizational principle would be to expand in the number of derivatives, because each derivative brings down a factor of momentum. So we started with no derivatives. Of course, we have this SU3 left cross SU3 right symmetry, and so we have to write down terms that are invariant under that symmetry. And we tried a term with no derivatives, but it wasn't really an interaction term at all. We wrote down this, which is certainly invariant, but it's 3. 3 is not much of an interaction term in a Lagrangian, unless you couple it to gravity. Then it has enormous consequences. You'd look out, if it was really 3 in some normal units, we'd be squished. But anyways, let's go on. So the first term you can get in the derivative expansion involves 2 derivatives. The trace you put in to make it invariant. And I'm going to put an f squared over 8 here. And then there's plus more derivatives. So let's think about this Lagrangian, what it's got in it with just 2 derivatives. Well, you have to remember that sigma has a whole power series in M. So in this Lagrangian, let's look what we got. The lowest order term counting numbers of m's is a term with, well, the derivative hits the 1, you get 0. So the lowest one is 1m here and 1m there. That's what we would normally call a kinetic term. There's going to be an f in the denominator. An f in the denominator here, which will kill the f squared. Hence why I put the f squared there. And if I have, for example, a term in this expansion that goes like d mu pi plus pi minus, I want the coefficient to be 1. The 8 does that. So if you put the 8 here, and you plug these in and multiply it all out, taking the trace, the term with 2 m's, you'll get standard, properly normalized kinetic terms. A half d mu pi 0 d mu pi 0, 1 d mu pi plus d mu pi minus, etc. That's the reason I picked this coefficient. If you look in somebody else's paper, if they use the sigma notation, they might not put the 2, and then they put a different thing down here. Doesn't change any of the physics. There's some conventions in there. So I actually expanded it out. I took the trace in my notes. But if you understand how it goes, then let's just not do the algebra on the board to save a little time. Everybody understand that? I can do one of the terms with the pi pluses if it would make you feel more comfortable. Anybody want that? Yes?
You said the trace makes it invariant. And invariant with respect to what?
SU3 left cross SU3 right. You want me to show you that? So, purple chalk. We're going purple here. Let's transform it. So here, let's transform it. So here I'll get d mu L sigma R dagger dagger. D mu L sigma R dagger. Oopsie. So when I take the dagger, I get an R on this side, which hits the R dagger, which is 1. Now I have an L dagger on this side, which inside the trace, I can move over, it hits the L, makes a 1. Okay?
And why is it the full symmetry group, or the full global symmetry instead of just the unbroken one?
Well, think about this. Think about, what do we mean by spontaneously broken symmetry? We mean the Lagrangian has the symmetry, but the vacuum doesn't. So the Lagrangian will have the full symmetry, but the sigma has this expectation value of that
right,
breaks the symmetry.
Fluctuations above this ground state and still
right. It has dynamics. It's a really subtle and important point. So the spectrum doesn't reflect the symmetry. But much of the dynamic still does of these massless degrees of freedom in a way which I'll show you for working towards. Pretty amazing, this subject. Okay. So as we go forward, what's in here? So now we've got the kinetic terms, but there's more going on. There's terms with 3m's, terms with 4m's, and so there's interactions in this theory. There's pi pi to pi pi scattering, there's pi pi to pi pi, pi pi scattering, and there's only one number that characterizes all the physics, this f. So this theory has an incredible amount of predictive power. The pions, the kaons have complicated interactions containing an arbitrary number of fields, but only one constant determines all the physics, f. So this is the symmetry, the power of the symmetry that we had in the theory. So let's look at terms with 3m's to start with. So the terms with 3m, so I'm taking the part of the Lagrangian that contains 3 meson fields. I got a trace, and then a sigma dagger, so that's the one won't contribute because I have a derivative. So I get minus 2i d mu m over f, and then I have to pick something with 2m's, that was minus 4m squared over 2f squared. And then I have the and then there's f squared over 8 out in front of the whole thing. And then I have to get the 2m's from here, plus trace d mu minus 4m squared over 2f squared from the dagger, but there's no I here, so it doesn't get complex conjugated. And here I get d mu 2i m over f. What's this equal to? So this came from the sigma dagger, hence the minus sign. This the sigma, this the sigma dagger, this the sigma, so no minus sign. There's no I here, so it's the same as here. Please answer this question for me. I'll give you an enormous cash reward. I'm going up to 30 cents now, because we got to keep moving fast. Who said zero? Congratulations, you can add. You can add x plus minus x, but I'm still going to give you this awesome 30 cents. This one's got a beaver on it. Zero! No 3-meson interaction. Yeah?
This is one of those partial derivatives not supposed to be there in the first term.
Oh, yeah, the one I keep putting it inside and outside. That might have been quite part of the reason it took you so long. Zero, nothing with 3m's, but there are terms with 4m's that survive. And I wrote down some of them in the notes. This is supposed to be a theory. A theory means you do quantum mechanics, not just classical physics. Quantum mechanics is loops. Tree graphs are classical physics. We got to talk about loops. Loop diagrams. So what's a loop diagram here? Well, we had a vertex with 4 of these m's involving 2 derivatives, and it went something like p squared. How about the f's? There's 4 m's, there'll be 4 f's downstairs. The Lagrangian had an f squared upstairs, so this will give you an amplitude that goes something like this, where p is just a generic momentum now. Could be p1 dot p2, but I'm just denoting all the momentum by p. Well, there's something else that can contribute to this amplitude.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we got to imagine computing this. We're not going to actually do the calculation, but we have to imagine what it would go like with our vast knowledge of loop diagrams and things of that nature from our experience. So first we have to choose our subtraction, our regulator subtraction scheme, dimensional regularization, minimal subtraction, like we always do. What is this graph going to go like? Well, first of all, there's 1 over f squared here, 1 over f squared here, so there's 1 over f to the fourth. Something's got to make up the rest of the dimensions. It's dimensionless, right? Well, what do we got with dimensions of mass? We have p and mu, the subtraction point. But mu only enters in the arguments of logarithms. And so we get something like p to the 4 log. Maybe there's a and plus a constant. Okay, let's think about this a little more. Well, first of all, we say, hoo-hoo! Why am I so ecstatic? Well, I want to do a derivative expansion, right? I want to count powers of p. P was supposed to be very small. Oh, let me show off a bit. We've got lots of experience. We know where the pi's go. P is supposed to be small. Small compared to what? Well, this has got 4 p's. If p is small, I should be able to make this smaller than this. And so that'll be true if p is much less than 4 pi f. That's the region of momenta where I can just get away with calculating this, and this will be a small correction. And higher loops will have more f's downstairs and more p's upstairs, pretty clear. What else do I want to say? Well, I stopped at 2 derivatives. So let's say I want to work at this order, at order p to the 4. What else would I have to add? I'd have to compute this diagram, but I also would have to add things in the Lagrangian like this. This is a term with 4 derivatives. Yes?
So for that to be true, we have to choose a subtraction point.
Usually you'll choose it around p squared, the relevant momenta is usually what you do. And I'm going to tell you what cancels the mu dependence in a moment, how you would derive a renormalization group equation. Yes?
So I see that 4 pi f causes some cancellation of the denominator, but why is that value a cutoff for momentum that enable the loop to contribute some relevant amount?
Well, we could ask, when is this term here as big as this term? I want to know, when is this a small correction? So I would pull out a p squared over f squared, and then what's left is what makes this small, which is p squared over 4 pi f squared. Kind of the logarithm is order 1. So this condition is the condition for which what's called chiral perturbation theory, this expansion in momenta, is valid. If p is equal to 4 pi f, this term's as big as this term, and 2 loops will be as big, etc. So there's a region of momenta where p is much less than 4 pi f, much less could be a third in this business, where we can do a momentum expansion. And so we know how to do the leading order. It's from that Lagrangian, f squared over 8, trace d mu sigma dagger. You just write, you expand sigma in terms of m, you write Feynman rules, you compute. There'll be lots of examples of that on your final homework. But let's say I now want to correct the formulas by the p to the 4th stuff. So I have to compute the loop graphs. But an operator like this in my chiral Lagrangian with 4 derivatives with some coefficient c also gives you a p to the 4th. And so I have to include it. And it has a coefficient with subtraction point dependence. And the subtraction point dependence of this coefficient will cancel a subtraction point dependence here to give you amplitudes that are subtraction point independent. And you could use that to write your normalization group equations for the coefficients if you wanted to. Of course, there's many operators with four derivatives, not just this one. With two derivatives, there was only that operator, up to integrations by parts, which don't affect things. So here there's several. I'm not going to write them out. We're never going to work at this order in this class. But you keep going. If you go to two loops, then it ends up that's like p to the sixth. And then you need operators with six derivatives as well, et cetera, et cetera. That's how you do chiral perturbation theory. So at a given order in the momentum expansion, there's always a finite number of things you have to compute. And for some decays, like kaon decays, it's been done to quite high order. Everything's been done for four derivatives. That's just what it's called. It's called that because the symmetry was a chiral symmetry. The lefts transform different than the rights. And the broken generators are the ones that are chiral. The unbroken ones are the vector ones where the lefts and rights transform the same way. So most people will call it now chiral perturbation theory. But really, a better name for it would be the momentum expansion. Perturbation theory and powers of momenta. That would actually be a better name. Okay, so that's the other key physics point. We have a Lagrangian with a symmetry. So, yes? In the coefficients,
yeah,
C.
Where is that coming from?
Well, in a Lagrangian, when you renormalize it, the couplings develop subtraction point dependence, like E did, it was a beta function, the mass parameters did, and so will this. But physical amplitudes are subtraction point independent, and so that this dependence here will cancel the mu dependence here if we calculate some pi-pi scattering amplitude.
But on the two derivative operator, there was no subtraction.
Yeah, F squared just gets pulled out front. It might develop subtraction point at higher order as well when you do loops. I don't remember. I think so, actually. Everything gets renormalized. But at leading order, there's no subtraction point dependence. We don't have to worry about it. You have to renormalize the theory. It's a non-renormalizable theory. You need an infinite number of operators to renormalize this exactly, but not in the momentum expansion. That's the point. In the momentum expansion, there's always a finite number of operators at any given power of p, which is what I've shown you there, at least in this simple example. Okay, so if I wanted to, everything will get corrected. The F in front will get corrected by loop diagrams, but we're going to work mostly at the leading order. So what do you usually do? You could have an operator involving quarks in the fundamental theory, and you might want to know if that was in the Hamiltonian, how you would represent it for low momentum physics as an operator involving the fields, the pi, the k, the eta. So what you would do is you'd work out how that operator transforms in the quark theory under SU3 left cross SU3 right. Then you would write out something that transforms the same way in this effective theory with the least number of derivatives. And that would be your starting point. And then order by order, you could add more derivative terms. And in general, the coefficient of it in the effective theory would be an unknown new parameter. You have to determine it from experiment. Except for one case. There's special operators, which are the operators like this. Q bar, gamma mu. Operators like this. Well, this is an SU, this is a generator of SU3, left, in this case SU3 right. These operators here, they're the nether currents for the chiral symmetry. Did you learn about Nether's theorem and field theory? Well, I'm going to go over it. They're the nether currents for the chiral symmetry. You can figure out what they are just by transforming the Lagrangian. So this is at the quark level. These will match up and be equal to the nether currents in the chiral Lagrangian. It's the same symmetry. So in that case, there's no unknown coefficient. I know what those currents are. Let's go through that exercise. The symmetry currents.
So TAs here are generators of left and right.
Right. They're SU3 traceless Hermitian matrices. But you can take coefficients with an I, so they can more or less be, you know, you could even have something like this, 0, 0, 1. Because that's just linear combinations of these currents for the TA.
But the TA are generators for the SU3.
Right, or linear combinations of those generators. Because that would just be a linear combination of the currents. So often people will write down in here something like this, which is not Hermitian, but it's a linear combination of two of these currents, one of the involving an I, let's say. Okay, so how do you find the nether currents? We're doing time-wise, it's not too bad. So one way you could do it is you can take, so let's do the left half. You take Q left to L Q left, that's a global symmetry. You make it infinitesimal. Then you look at your Lagrangian. It contains Q bar left, I, gamma mu, d mu, Q left, plus Q bar right, I, gamma mu, d mu, Q right, plus where the other terms don't involve the derivatives, because the nether currents come from terms with derivatives. And then you would say, according to the formula that you learned, it's something like, well, there's different conventions for the current. You know, if I have a current, you're just going to do minus I and delta Q left here would be I T A Q left. There's one generator for each alpha A, so I take them one at a time. And so maybe I messed up here. Let me leave this out to start with, and let's see what I get. So I'm going to get here Q bar left, I'm going to have the I, gamma mu, d mu, then I'll have I, T A, Q left, and there's no derivative because I've taken that, that's what I buried with respect to. And so I guess if I want to make it look what I had before, I should adopt the convention where there's a minus there. And so I'll just get
which terms did you say we dropped in the Lagrangian?
The terms involving the gluon, the gauge field, because the nether current comes from the terms with derivatives. There's another way to identify the nether current, which is to gauge this symmetry, and then the thing that multiplies the gauge boson is the current. Gauge boson couples to the current. People use both ways in the literature. So that's the nether current. And now you can make the same, you can do the same thing It's actually more convenient to do it with the gauging mechanism and do it in the theory with the sigmas. And so what do you learn? You learn that J left A, which is equal to Q bar left TA Q left is equal to, so I worked it out in the notes. I'm trying to save a little time by just telling you the story. And similarly for the rights.
What do you mean by gauging or to derive the current by gauging?
Okay, so here we have no quark masses here, so the SU3 left symmetry is an exact symmetry. So I could gauge it. I could add a gauge boson for that group, write down a gauge invariant kinetic term, and then there'd be a term that where A mu for that gauge boson coupled to something, and that thing is the current, like an electromagnetism. So, of course, we haven't really gauged it. It's just a way to identify the current. And even if the theory is not exact and you have mass terms, you just set those to zero, you gauge it, and you look at the form of the thing that couples to A mu, and that's the current. So those are the two ways, either this Nether formula or to gauge it, that you can identify the current. And let's see. So what does that mean? Amongst the operators here, there's an example. I could pick TA, so this was U bar gamma mu 1 minus gamma 5 D. Here's one of the currents. Yes?
I'm missing a gamma mu.
Yes, I am. Thank you. Very important. So remember in the weak interactions, there was something like G over G2 over 2 root 2 V U D this times W plus mu plus the Hermitian conjugate. Look at this. This is the weak current. So if we're interested in pions coupling to, or pion, any of these particles, pi is the case, etc., coupling to this W boson, I just take this object, put in the appropriate T, so this is equal to this. And, well, there'll be a half in this case, so I might put a half back in, and then that's equal to this. And then I can go ahead and calculate in the theory with just pions at low momentum. No unknown coefficients, everything expressed just in terms of F. It's pretty cool. That's not true for every operator. If I had an operator like this, let's say I had a weak interaction that could do S bar D U bar U. Let's say there's a term like this in the Hamiltonian. This is not a Nether current. So if I want to represent that in terms of sigma, I'll have unknown coefficients in front of the operators writing down something that transforms like this does. Yes?
So I thought we were doing strong interaction. So
when the W couples, there's a strong part to the problem. There's a matrix element of this, maybe to produce 4 pions or 3 pions. I want to know that part. I want to know how the... So what, I might be interested in a problem like this. Pi comes in, and 2 pi's go out, various charges. Then I have the W, and then I have, I don't know why I'd be interested in this. It's a crazy type, but you know what I mean. This part can have arbitrary hadronic physics in it. And we want to do that hadronic physics at low momentum. The W would be virtual. Similarly, we could be interested in kaon decays. Let me do an example. Let's say this was your operator. Part of the weak Hamiltonian looks like this. And so this would be V US V U D, let's say. Yeah, in front. Okay, part of the weak Hamiltonian looks like that. How does this transform under SU3 left plus SU3 right? Well, this is a singlet, and this is in the octet. So you write it transforms like octet left, singlet right. And then if I want to write an effective Hamiltonian, I would write it at, well, maybe I put the GF over root 2, the Vs. One of these is star, don't worry about it. And then I'd put some new coefficient, C, which I don't know, and I'd write down an operator with the least number of derivatives that transforms in this way. And that operator, I think, is trace. Some matrix, what should I call the matrix? I always call them T. D mu sigma, D mu sigma dagger. And T would have to be the right thing to take the strange to the down. So something like something like that. Hits an S quark, brings it to the second column, which is the down one. And then C, I wouldn't know. I'd fit it to the data for, let's say, for k to 2 pi. The difference in the current case is there's no C. I know everything. But the current case is about the only one where that's true, unfortunately. What have we left out so far? We left out a big piece of physics.
Mass.
Mass, right. The pi, the k, the eta, they're not massless. We got the quark masses are small compared to 4 pi f, we learned that that's the relevant expansion. But they're not zero, so we want to include them in the expansion. Plus, you know, p squared is kind of like the mass squared of one of these particles, if you're working at, and so, you know, we got to include it. It's not going to be negligible. So we got to figure out how to include it. This is the last remaining conceptual piece to the problem. So what we're going to do is we're going to go back to the quark theory and look at the mass terms. Everybody with me so far? A lot of physics in this stuff. You know, not much math, but a lot of physics. So you just got to think about it. You can come torment me, it's okay. I don't mind. Well, it probably would have been better to not phrase it as torment. But. Let me erase this. While I'm erasing, anybody interested in going out for beer like we did the first week? Hands. We'll meet at 7 downstairs again, those that want to go. Go out for an hour or so, have a beer, someplace close. Last time was pretty close. Let's write out the QCD Lagrangian again. Everything follows from that if you were strong enough to actually do computations in the non-perturbative regime. Well, I'm going to write this in a crazy way. I'm going to take this last term, and I'm going to write it as q bar right, mq dagger, q left. These terms are not invariant under SU3 left cross SU3 right. They have a certain transformation property. And there's two ways. So what we're going to do is we're going to represent these terms in the chiral Lagrangian by something that transforms the same way as they do. Under SU3 cross SU3 left cross SU3 right. And then we have to do a little group theory. I don't know any group theory. So I have to avoid doing group theory or I have to make it trivial. I have to make it simple. So So I'm going to show you how to do the group theory to make it simple. It's actually got a name, this method. It's called the Spurion method. So M is a fixed matrix, right? It's not a field, just a fixed matrix. But let's pretend it transformed. Well, how would it have to transform to make this invariant? MQ would have to go to L MQ R dagger. Then both of these terms would be invariant. Okay, awesome. If I want to write down my chiral Lagrangian, including the factors of MQ, I insert MQs, the 3x3 matrix, pretending they transform in this way, and write down invariants. Pretty cool way to do group theory, isn't it?
I mean, when you say transform in this case, you're talking about the SE3L
code. Right, that's what I'm talking about. Okay, well, let's write out the simplest thing we can. We're now going to fix up our chiral Lagrangian. So here we go. I'm going to write down this is the chiral Lagrangian for the strong interactions. Well, we need a parameter for these terms. They're not nether currents or anything, so I'm going to call the parameter V. And then I get trace MQ dagger sigma plus sigma dagger MQ. It's Hermitian.
What does V parameterize?
We have these terms in the theory of QCD. I want to write corresponding terms in the chiral Lagrangian, linear order in MQ. So I wrote down something. This has the right transformation property, but nothing tells me the normalization. I've just added something that transforms the same way. That's all I know. I don't know what the coefficient is. So there's just some new parameter that characterizes that coefficient. I'll tell you how to determine that in a moment.
Not any of the V's that
we've been
encountering
each other. Well, you could think of it as the same as the V in O, but I haven't really shown you why. For us, we can just call it another V. It's some parameter of dimensions of mass cubed. So the first thing we should do is figure out the pi, the k, the eta masses, right? Now they'll have masses. We've explicitly broken the chiral symmetry, so in this term there should be mass terms for those fields. So first thing you might worry about if there was a linear term in the fields. What if there was something linear in pi, k, and eta? That would mean that we expanded about the wrong point. The expectation value of sigma wasn't 1, but there is no linear term. You get an I, and then you get a minus I with the M, and they cancel against each other. So the first term is the 1. Again, that's the cosmological constant. It would be a huge deal if it was that big. I mean, we'd be squashed. But we don't care about that in this class. And the next term involves two M's, and those are going to be the mass terms for the pi, the k, the eta. So let's look at the mass terms. Everybody with me so far? Okay, well, you got to come see me. I'm only here for a few more days. Time's a winding down. Friday, you're going to get this enormous problem set with incredibly difficult, detailed things involving chiral Lagrangian. If you don't understand something, you'll be cursing me all weekend. Okay, so on that positive note, you say sigma is exponential 2im over f, which is 1 plus 2im over f, minus 4m squared over f squared with a 2, so I get a 2, So what do I get?
So the L mass, I got the minus sign out front. I get the 2 over F squared. The terms, and then I get 2 terms, and then I get trace M squared M cubed. It's minus 4 over F squared trace M squared M cubed, which equals minus 4 over, oh, times the V. Times M up, M squared 1, 1, plus M down, M squared 2, 2, plus M strange, M squared 3, 3. So we got F. We wrote out M somewhere. There it is, that big thing. We just square it up, multiply by those, and pick out the mass terms for all the mesons in there. So I did that in complete detail, actually, in my notes, but I'll just write it out for you. So here's some of the mass terms we get from this exercise. I get M squared pi plus and minus. One's the antiparticle, the other, they have the same masses. That's a theorem in quantum field theory, which you probably didn't learn. But a particle and antiparticle always have the same mass, the same decay width.
Wouldn't we if these masses are just after you substitute in the M11 and so on, these are terms that
are they're masses because they're quadratic in the fields. There's no derivatives, they're quadratic in the fields, and so those are the things that are the mass terms in the Lagrangian. And so, for example, if there's a term here, pi plus pi minus, the coefficient of that is the mass squared of that scalar field. They're actually mass squared terms for scalars, would be a better way to put it, but people still call them mass terms.
So the single parameter V kind of predicts.
Right, they're all proportional
all the
to V.
Masses.
Right.
Because we know the mu, mv, and ms.
Well, we learn about them from ratios here where the V cancels out. So we learn about them from ratios here and from lattice QCD. And if you put it all together, we pretty much know them. Yeah. And there, you know, basically all you really predict are so when you do lattice QCD, you say what they are at a subtraction point. Here you get ratios, the subtraction point dependence cancels out. Piece of leading order. So what are you going to get? There'll be a 4v over f squared, and this goes like mu plus mv. Yes?
How do the mass dimensions work out? If v, if everything in that equation has v1.
V has dimensions of mass cubed.
Okay.
That's it has to.
Right, because
yeah, otherwise it wouldn't work. And so V we just sucked in there. It comes from some non-perturbative physics, so whatever dimensions it has to be is what it is. It's some unknown coefficient that you fit to data like this. Let's say you would determine the quark masses through lattice QCD, then you would get V for these formulas. And F, from which I'm going to tell you how to determine next class. So let me write it out. So here's something peculiar about these formulas. So first of all, it's got to be that as the quark masses go to zero, these meson masses go to zero because they'd be Goldstone, but they'd be these massless, in quotes, Goldstone bosons without that. But it's not the mass that's proportional to the quark masses, it's the mass squared. And then, in the pi zero eta sector, there's some mixing. So I got there's a mass squared matrix. So I write the Lagrangian like this. I have pi zero eta m squared. This is like a mass matrix. And what you get for that mass matrix is
if I did it right. I looked in the book.
So what I got for this mass matrix is the thing at the far right. But if you look at these mass ratios, the K is quite a bit heavier than the pi, and then it occurs squared here. And so MS is much greater than MU and MD. It's about 20 times greater than MD. And MU is about half MD. And so since MS is much greater than MU and MD, basically the mixing between the pi zero and the eta is small, and the pi zero mass is about the same as the pi plus pi minus masses. This mixing also violates isospin, because the eta is a singlet under isospin, and the pi zero is a triplet under isospin, part of a triplet. That's why you get MU minus MD in the top there. How about our power counting? Well, since the mass squared of the meson is linear in the quark mass, what you do is you change your power counting to say every two derivatives is the same as a single quark mass. So if I want to write down my Lagrange, I'll get there in a second. If I want to write down my Lagrangian including two derivative terms, I have to include that linear in quark mass term. When I went to four derivatives before, I'd have to include two insertions of the quark mass. That would also be the same order, etc. Yes?
What do you mean by power counting? What do you mean?
So power counting was what order in momentum does something contribute? Right? We want to work consistently in any physical problem to a given order in the momentum expansion. So figuring what order you're at, what contributes to the given order, I'm calling power counting.
And just in the context of when you're using.
Well, we want to calculate our amplitude at a given order in this momentum expansion. And so we figure out what diagrams we need at that order, and we also figure out what terms in the Lagrangian we need at that order. Because this is an effective theory, we can keep adding more and more terms to the Lagrangian with more and more derivatives. So we have to figure out where to stop to get the answer correct to a given order in the momentum.
So how do you spin
to... Okay, so you'll notice that the mass squared, which is like two powers of momenta, is linear in the quark mass. And so it's consistent to keep one power of quark mass and two derivatives. They're both contributing something of order p squared. P is of order of momentum, of order of mass. But it's not one mass insertion for one derivative. It's one mass insertion for two derivatives. That's the little bit different thing. Yes?
So why do we define the pi plus pi minus, I mean the coefficient of this cross term, the mass of the...
Yeah, so if you have a Lagrangian involving the pi plus and pi minus, the free field theory would be this. Because, you know, pi plus is equal to pi minus dagger. They're antiparticles, and so this is just d mu phi dagger, d mu phi minus m squared phi dagger phi, the usual form of the Lagrange.
Okay, so.
But for a neutral particle like a pi zero, then you put a half here and a half here.
So, yeah, this definition is like similar to when we define the mass of a quark, is that?
Well,
then,
a quark is a fermion, so it's different. It's like q bar d slash q. It's different than that. It's more like the Higgs scalar, if you'd like.
The complex scalar field.
So the complex scalar field, right. So if you field theory did complex scalar fields, you should know how to normalize it and what these terms mean. So there's just a few more things I'm going to do in chiral perturbation theory, probably half the lecture next time. And then we'll move on to a few other topics. I'm going to talk about discrete symmetries in the standard model, parity, charge conjugation, CP, charge conjugation times parity, and how it's violated. And I'm going to talk about another expansion like this, the heavy quark expansion, but just a little bit. So Think about it. Bring your questions to me. I'm here to serve you. I don't remember what we put up yesterday. We'll look. I have now the lecture notes for what I think will be the whole class. So I'll make sure everything is up today.
You just put up some corrections yesterday for lecture six.
But I think you also put up some additional ones.
Some additional lectures,
yeah. Which I added more to today, so we'll replace some things today. I added more to it last night. Okay, so if I don't see you later today, I'll certainly see some of you at 7. You head out into the frozen wasteland to drink a cold beer.